So on this time on a Thursday, because this is pretty much the last show of the week as far as the home run is concerned, we get into a kind of Shabbat vibe and we're thinking about the Shabbat meal and food and food and food. So this has become the food slot where we talk to somebody who knows about food. Today I'm really delighted that we get to chat to Chef Yehuda Jacobs, a kosher private chef and culinary instructor who is in Israel. Chef Yehuda Jacobs, thank you for chatting to me this afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you doing?
I am well, and I've got a big smile on my face because we're going to talk about my favorite topic on the planet right now, which is food. Tell me a little bit, Yehuda, about your food journey.
Well, I got to tell you, you have a real Jewish soul if you go right for the food, I got to tell you.
Why wouldn't I?
Hey. So my culinary journey started when I was a kid. Basically, I grew up in the United States, moved to Israel when I was 10 in 1995. And growing up, my mom wanted to go back to work. She wanted to focus more on work. So she said to me and my brothers and my sisters, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to teach you all how to cook so I could go back to work so you guys could fend for yourselves. Mm-hmm. Besides that, she also taught us to do laundry and stuff like that because she really wanted us to, you know, fend for ourselves. So she really taught the basics, you know, of things how to get done. But the real passion for the cooking came from my bubby, from my grandmother, may she rest in peace, where she loved to host. She lived to host people. She came up from nothing, the Lower East Side, growing up in New York. And anytime we would be in her house or be in her presence, it's always about the love for hospitality, the love for food. And that really is what gave me the drive and the passion to actually get into food. And I started basically my culinary journey professionally. I started when I was 15 in different catering companies, worked at a butcher shop for 3 years until I was 18. Eventually went to the army, got settled in, I got married. And then that's when I really started my actual professional journey in Israel, where I went to culinary school here in Jerusalem. And basically I started there, and then I went to college to actually get a degree to learn about the industry from the other side, in basically in tourism management. So, and then I did digital food, and then I went back to cooking, and I've been doing this. It's just been a very, very long time that I've been doing this. So I also just got a global picture of food. And during all this time, in the past 10 years, I've been traveling the world as a private kosher chef and really picking up a lot of different cuisines from around the world just by working abroad with amazing chefs, doesn't matter if they were Jewish or not, and just really absorbing local culture and bringing that to the cooking that I do in Israel and around the world.
We're going to get into that in a little more detail in just a moment. I'm just thinking, goodness me, there must be easier ways to make a living than to be involved with food. It is just so unbelievably personal. I mean, something that you absolutely love and adore, I might loathe. It's such an individual thing. Do you struggle with that?
Of course I do. Everybody struggles with it. I've been doing it for so long. People say, how do you have the drive to do it? So what I always tell people is food is an art form. It's just like when a musician sits down with a guitar or with his piano trying to figure out something new. Now, we're not reinventing the wheel here. You know, food has been around since the beginning of time. And art has been around for so long. Like I said, as a painter, a musician. And we're just taking different inspirations from different things. Like one of the things that I do around Israel, for example, when I don't cook, is I do culinary tours of the markets of Israel. And one really amazing thing about Israel, the culture here in Israel, is the food through the people that have come, the Jews from around the world and the Arab neighbors that have been around here for many, many years. And everyone like has just such a different cuisine and a different take on food. And it's just inspiring every single day to learn something different or to taste something different. and really just constantly be getting inspired to just get up and do it again every single day.
So I'm listening to you and I'm looking at your name, Yehuda Jacobs, and you just said Lower East Side, Manhattan. I'm thinking briskets, I'm thinking cholent, I'm thinking lokshen. This whole introduction of the Mizrahi Sephardi cuisine must have been a mind blow for you in terms of utilization of different spices and harissa and, you know, things that we just don't know in our cuisine.
Correct. So when it comes to Ashkenazi cuisine, which is more of the, you know, Hungarian, Polish, German world of food, we're very used to very, very basic spices. My mother-in-law is Polish. She uses paprika, salt, pepper, and garlic powder and onion. Like that's and then she married an Egyptian.
Oh,
my
wow.
Father-in-law.
Oh, wow.
Who put in a little... Then she married my father-in-law, who's Egyptian, and suddenly cumin and cilantro was introduced to her life. And then suddenly, like, a little bit more seasoning came into her life. But yeah, when I went to high school, I learned in a dormitory. I didn't live at home. And suddenly you're eating couscous on a Tuesday. And it was mind-blowing to know that, first of all, who eats soup and pot, like, because couscous is like a pasta. It just didn't make any sense. But then you're eating it, and now here in Israel, it's like a staple. Every Tuesday, people eat couscous, or Shabbat and Friday night. It's just unbelievable, to taste these things and learn about these things. You
talk about couscous, and I think it comes out of a box. But back at the ranch, when I was in Israel, I actually learned it doesn't for 1 second come out of a box. That it's a whole process, and it's hours and hours of work. And somebody once said to me, actually, a Sephardic aunt of mine who married my uncle said, Sephardi food was invented by men to keep women in the kitchen. And do you agree with that? Do you think that it's just very labor-intensive, Sephardic food?
So as a guy who's traveled to Morocco, which is one of the motherlands of couscous, in the Sephardic cuisine, the mother is the home. She is the center of the home, period. Mm-hmm. Meaning the house cannot function without the mother. So there is something to say about that, but I think it was the mother's plan. So the husband thought he did it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. Let's bring this to a Shabbat dinner now. Let's talk Shabbat and food. What is your favorite dish that would always spark a conversation at a Shabbat table?
So interesting enough, lately, you know, with all of what's going on the internet in the world, some of the classics are forgotten. Because we have Judaism is so wide and vast of the different sects that we have in Judaism, from the ultra-Orthodox to the modern Orthodox to Reform to conservative. Everyone gets inspiration, like, to cook, but, like, it just seems to be that, like, classic Ashkenazi food, and I'm not even talking about cholent. Cholent has become, like, a worldwide phenomenon. I don't know if you've ever heard of this phenomenon of Thursday night called Lel Shishi, where people are eating cholent on Thursday night to get prepared for Shabbat. I don't know if they do that down in South Africa.
No, we don't.
But in New York, on the East Coast, and in Israel, Thursday night, people go out. It doesn't matter who you are. People go out to eat Shabbat food on Thursday night. It's become this cultural phenomenon. So everybody now knows about kugel and
really?
Cholent and yapchik and kishka. It's become such a thing.
Oh my goodness. It's unimaginable to me.
It's become such a phenomenon.
You know, I was watching some YouTube video the other evening about some sort of deli in Bnei Brak. And you walk into this warehouse. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. It was huge, and every single conceivable prepared food you could imagine, everything you're talking about was all there, plus all the Sephardic delicacies. And I thought, they've taken it to a new level. It's not that sad, gray-looking food that it was 20 years ago.
No, absolutely not. So if you're asking me something that sparks a conversation, you ready for this? It's something that I don't know if you've heard of. But there's a dish that's called kasha varnishkis. Okay, have you ever heard of that before?
Kasha varnishkis. You're joking. Kasha varnishkis.
Okay, so kasha basically is the European word for buckwheat, and varnishkis is pasta.
No.
So basically is where they take buckwheat, where they boil it up and fry it with onions, and then they take pasta, which they boil, and then they put it together with just basic seasoning, salt, pepper, little bit of garlic, and it's just Now, buckwheat is a very acquired taste, but again, people who grew up in, you know, Eastern Europe and stuff like that really are, you know, accumulated to that taste, the taste of buckwheat. If I give my kid buckwheat today, they look at me like I'm nuts. Like, I responded to that when I was growing up when someone gave me quinoa the first time.
Exactly.
You know,
it just didn't
register. But I grew up on a dish like that. So when I bring that up, or when I got to tell you also, one of the biggest things also here, South Africans in Israel love is herring. Okay. Herring used to be just a simple delicacy that people would, after the synagogue in the morning, they would have a little kiddush, they'd have a cracker and a little bit of herring, which is just a little piece of fish with that's marinated with onions and a little bit of peppers, and that was it. Now you have hundreds of flavors of herrings. It's become this, again, a cultural phenomenon that people are taking fresh fish and turning it into herring. They're curing it themselves and doing different flavors from spicy to sweet to savory. And this all is based off of the classic Ashkenazi food. And these are like things
you see,
that
you're losing
up in
me
a conversation.
Here. You're losing me here. We can't be talking about herring because there's nothing worse on the planet than herring. You want to talk about chrami? You got me. You want to talk about Moroccan dag Morokai? I'm with you. But herring, I'm sorry. That should have stayed in Eastern Europe with the Eastern Europeans. I don't know why it made it across. I just don't. Maybe, I don't know.
Are you ready for this, though? The Sephardim love herring.
No, you know, don't say that. Don't say that.
So you ready? So they don't like herring specifically. They like smoked fish. Okay? And that's a lot of people in around North Africa and in the Middle East, they love the smoked fish. So again, when it comes to debating and talking about a conversation, it's how people take these fish and then suddenly create it into something, whether you're Ashkenazi or Sephardi. It's very, very interesting when you're sitting around the table, especially here in Israel, where it's become part of the culture, that like around the same table, you have someone that has, you know, his grandmother's from Tripoli, or his other grandmother's from Iraq or Lebanon or from, you know, Poland or whatever. And you're having a conversation about the same thing, just coming from four different views. But if I bring a Sephardi, Kashavar Mishkis, they're going to go, what?
Yeah, and I'm just thinking around. I mean, you've mentioned the Tripolitaim, the Tunisaim, and the Luvaim, and whatever. They all stuff vegetables in a way that we just never did.
Correct.
As part of Ashkenazi food. I don't know why. Maybe there weren't vegetables in Northern Europe, but they seem to just. I mean, even a kishui. What's that in English? Kishuim. Leek.
Courgettes.
How do you
zucchini.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they even stuff that. That to me is, I don't know, Jewish genius to do that.
I could give you the explanation to that. Why did people stuff it? And it's not only the Jews. It's anyone that lived in this region. Because vegetables and rice do not cost a lot of money. And when you take the rice with a little bit of ground beef that you have, because beef, it costs a lot of money. People couldn't always afford beef during the week.
Makes sense.
So to do a delicacy, to do something special, they would take the rice and they would take the beef and put it into vegetables and in the tomato sauce and create a dish out of it. And this way they were able to stretch their money for longer and enjoy a little bit of meat and enjoy like a whole meal in a pot. Just all the, you know, you have your vegetable, you have your carb, you have your protein all in one bite. And
makes
it's
sense.
From stuffed grape leaves
makes
to
sense.
Stuffed onions. Stuffed beets, stuffed peppers.
It's just amazing. Absolutely amazing.
It is.
So you've lived this 100%. Charmed life. I mean, you're on private yachts and traveling the world, and you're a kosher chef. So I would imagine you've met some very wealthy, very difficult Jewish clientele. What is your most requested dish on these exotic getaways?
To be honest with you, everyone loves a good piece of steak.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Like, no joke.
That's disappointing.
Just, but their number one request is wherever we travel, please bring the local cuisine. So before I prepare for a trip, I have to learn something that I did not know about. Like recently this past year, I went to the south of Italy, to the region of Puglia.
Yes.
Now, what I found out is Puglia is a very poor region. It's not one of the richer regions. It's not more than one of the more touristy regions. And there are certain things that over there that you're not going to find in Rome, and you're not going to find in the north in Venice and Naples. Like, Pizza is not their culture. Their culture is, you know, because they're farmers and they're olive growers and they're winemakers, but like seafood, because they're all across basically the heel of the boot, so they have access to the ocean. And over there, it's pork. Now, I wasn't going to cook any pork, obviously,
Obviously.
but we tried to take the local ideas and the local cuisine and the local pasta and incorporate it for the clients so they can really get an authentic
Taste of them,
Italian feel.
yeah.
Because at the end of the day, Italy is like, for example, it's such a large country. Everyone thinks it's just pizza and pasta. It's not.
Way more
Every region is
varied.
like a state.
Yoda, I've got one
It's
minute to go to news, so I'm going to have to leave it there, which is a great shame because I've enjoyed this delicious conversation with you. Just very quickly, last word to you. Where can we follow you and find out what it is that you do?
So you could go, my website is theisraelifoodie.com. I'm known as The Israeli Foodie on Instagram, and I have a very, very large Facebook group called Israeli Foodies, which talks about food in Israel in English for people who have questions that are coming to visit and want to know all about information in Israel about food.
Yehuda, we'll talk again. That was great. Thank you so much.